Warning, this show is about true crime, and its contents may not be appropriate for children.
This is the Crimecasters Network, with Alicia Safias and Ronnie Dahl. Two rogue reporters breaking newsroom rules to take you behind the crime scene tape.
Cheers, Crimecasters. Today's case is the one you'll tell your best friend and be like, can you believe this really happened? Alicia, I had to Google this when you told me about it because we don't want to make light of this subject, but this is bizarre.
I know. And even when you Googled it, there isn't really any information about it, so you still didn't really believe me. But here's the gist. It's a cold case where a teenager vanished in California and a man told police Bigfoot kidnapped her and he got away with it. Her disappearance sounds like a myth, and her childhood played out like a bad movie. But Teresa Beer's story is all too real. In 1987, Teresa is 16. And if there's one thing she needs in life, it's a break from reality, because hers absolutely sucks.
Since the day she was born, the people who are supposed to take care of her fail on every single level. Her mom abuses her badly, like, one time, she twists little Teresa's ankle around her crib until it breaks. And there are more injuries, worse ones. Finally, CPS gets involved and takes her and her sister, Vicky, away from their parents. Unfortunately, they don't end up in a stable home. They ping pong from one foster home to a foster home. Then they stay with a great-grandmother, then a family friend from church.
Until dear old dad comes a-knocking. He's married to a new woman now and wants his girls back. But it turns out stepmom is also abusive. So back they go to great-grandma's, which is really their safe place. Sadly, she can't afford to keep them on her fixed income. She had already taken in the girl's older sister, Yolanda, and has been raising her this whole time. There are three girls altogether, and Yolanda is the only one who has a stable home life. The other two aren't so lucky, especially Teresa. In comes a central figure to this story, and a guy you won't forget, Blind Johnny. Somewhat of an infamous character in this area. He's the outlaw, rebel without a cause type of guy, slicked back hair and dark shades he wears around the clock, because Blind Johnny is actually blind. He lost his sight after a game of Russian roulette went wrong, or a number of other reasons he gives whenever people ask.
Police say he's a low-level drug dealer and a fence. He sells stolen goods. His real name is John Richmond, and he happens to be Teresa's uncle. For some reason, though, Blind Johnny is allowed to become her legal guardian.
Teresa is a teenager now, and when she moves into his house, she basically becomes Cinderella, doing all of the dirty work, none of the credit. Here's a breakdown of her hellish living situation. We have 40-something Blind Johnny, his two young sons, his wife, and his girlfriend, who is only 17. The household is extremely toxic, full of drugs and shady men coming through the house all the time. The wife is a sex worker and often takes Teresa with her to out-of-town jobs so she can babysit the little boys while mommy works. The girlfriend is Tammy. She says Teresa is getting sexually abused and raped on the regular by random men.
When Teresa is 16, she confides in Tammy that her uncle, Blind Johnny, is also raping her. Teresa is only a freshman in high school, even though she's 16. She's really behind in school for obvious reasons. Not only does she miss class all of the time, but she's also a slow learner. Mentally not as advanced as her classmates, so she is in special education classes to try to help her.
Well, it's pretty hard to concentrate on algebra when your home life is complete and total chaos. And we tell you the details of her abuse because it makes a lot of sense why she would want to have an escape. Why, when a man told her about a mythical creature living in the forest nearby that he could prove to her exists, why, maybe she would want more than anything to believe him.
We're talking about Russell Welch. Everyone calls him Skip. Skip is a self-proclaimed mountain man. He's 43 years old, a house painter by trade, but his work life is pretty spotty. His wife died of a drug overdose a couple of years ago, and although he is also doing drugs back then, it's gotten worse since she died.
Well, to give you an idea, at that time, the Central Valley was poised to become the meth capital of America. Not exactly the title a town is looking for, and Skip is right in the middle of it. But meth is not his first love. His first love is Bigfoot. It's all-consuming. He spends a lot of time in the mountains gathering what he says is evidence of an underground Bigfoot society. You may laugh, but he has proof, even pictures. And he treats this like a job. Like, he'll hike out into this remote area and analyze the dirt, collect bones, set up his camera, and just observe like an anthropologist.
This is in the Sierra Nevada mountains. We're talking the place that launched the gold rush, just at the base of Yosemite. Skip concentrates on the central area of the Sierra, so the mountains just east of Fresno. And he has found the hotbed of Bigfoot activity in an area he calls Ghost Canyon. You may not put a lot of weight into a meth-addicted mountain man, but he is far from the first person who has seen something strange in this area.
Before the Europeans were even in California, before Bigfoot, there was Hairy Man or Wild Man from Native American lore, popular with the North Fork Band of Mono Indians. And in the nearby foothills, the Tule River Indian Reservation has a rock shelter called Painted Rock. The shelter belonged to a prehistoric village, and it's covered with ancient pictographs. The artwork is up to 1,000 years old and depicts not only Bigfoot, but a whole Bigfoot family, known simply as the family.
Okay, so when you start to research this, you are going to go down a rabbit hole.
Yes.
And for me, it really is fascinating to see. And we are going to put some of the images up on social. But I have to ask you, what did you feel when you saw these pictures? What is up with the red eyes?
Well, yeah, so these are almost like ghost-like figures, almost like a child would paint, where they're kind of elementary, but they get the message across. You get the point that they saw something that looked like this, and they have these red, searing eyes, almost as if the eyes are bleeding. But those red eyes are something we want to note because they're going to come back into play. So the tribe's oral traditions back this up. The story is that Bigfoot is a caretaker to the recently dead and carries their bodies to Mount Tillman, just above Painted Rock. Outside of the tribe, more Bigfoot sightings right there, documented in the newspaper-type sightings, beginning 150 years ago. And Ronnie, I'm not talking the National Enquirer. Stories are appearing in respected community papers, and it ramps up in the mid-80s. Here is a cover of the Fresno Bee on August 9th, 1986.
And the cover says, "Bigfoot's back. High Sierra crew tells of terrifying encounter. Five construction workers building a bridge saw what they swear is Bigfoot. And the screams that let out, they say, can only be supernatural." To offer a more rational explanation, the reporter talked to physical anthropologist Roger Lajeunesse. He's a mountaineer and the head of Fresno State's anthropology department. He says it's dark out there and the guys were probably just exhausted. And while the professor downplays the event, it's not the first time he's heard something like this.
Yeah, a couple years before, this guy kept bugging his secretary. "I need to see the professor. I have evidence Bigfoot exists. I have to meet with him right away." Finally, Professor Lajeunesse caves and is like, "Fine, tell him to come in." And guess who walks through his door with a bag of evidence and a big old grin? Skip. Skip tells him about his multiple sightings and how there's this underground Bigfoot colony and pulls out a stack of photos a couple inches thick. "You see, there he is. There's one. And there's one." And the professor is like, "Those are shadows. No, no, no. Those are Bigfoot."
As he is leaving, he says, "Oh, wait, there is more. I have indisputable proof, and I am going to drop it off to your secretary tomorrow. And he does. He drops off something you would not believe, but a bag of bones. Professor Lajeunesse, the expert in this stuff, looks at them and says, they're probably from a large forest animal, not human, not Bigfoot. End of story.
Or so he thinks. It is 1987 when Skip walks through a different door, this one at Blind Johnny's place, where he meets 16-year-old Teresa. Since there are a lot of people coming and going, Teresa doesn't think much of it until he tells her all about Bigfoot. He gives her the rundown, the man, the myth, the legend stuff, and presents it as more of a fairy tale. Because the Bigfoot creatures he knows exist worship women. Hey, if you want, I'll take you there and show you myself. And so the plan is hatched. A week later, Skip takes her to Ghost Canyon, and the experience will change her life.
It's Monday morning, June 1st, 1987. Teresa goes through the typical motions, chores and getting ready for school. But really, she's excited to go on this Bigfoot adventure, and the Skip guy seems harmless enough. I mean, come on, he's an expert. He knows exactly where to go.
Well, there is one obstacle, and his name is Blind Johnny. Skip tells him, you know what? Let me just take Teresa to school. Okay. Well, that wasn't hard. Teresa grabs her books and climbs into Skip's beater, a 76 Monte Carlo. And because of that car, they're not headed to the mountains just yet. It's acting up. So he stops at his daughter Chandra's house. Chandra, who is 19, sadly, is not too surprised to see her dad with an underage girl. This is not his first rodeo, and she knows it. He's taken other young girls into the mountains before to see Bigfoot.
By this time, it's mid-morning, and Teresa's school is like, hey, where's Teresa? So they call home to report her absence. Blind Johnny answers, and get this. When they tell him Teresa isn't at school, he says, I know, she's sick and stayed home. He lied so easily.
Well, because it's Blind Johnny's world and we just live in it, Ronnie. He wants to handle this himself, keep everyone else out of it. He assumes she's skipping school to hang out with Skip. 12 hours later, Teresa is still not home. By now, Johnny has called around to learn more about this Skip guy he supposedly met last week. And the reviews are not good. Let's see. The virtual stranger you let drive off with your niece today is mentally unstable, has a thing for young girls, is obsessed with Bigfoot, oh, and a meth addict, which you probably already know because that's probably how you met him. So at 9:30 p.m., it's finally time to call the Fresno police. By the next morning, the missing persons report lands on the desk of fairly new detective Doug Stokes of the Fresno PD. He's about to go down a rabbit hole of epic proportions.
10 days in, Detective Stokes finally catches up with Skip and brings him into the station in cuffs because Skip has an outstanding DUI warrant. Then they question him.
And I know you love documents, Ronnie, so I shared the report with you. You can literally turn to any page and read a line to get an idea of exactly how the interrogation went.
And it basically reads, he further stated that he has established a strong relationship with this community of big feet. I'm always wondering, big
feet? I know.
Bigfoot?
Is that the plural? I don't know. That's what Skip said. He called them big feet.
That lived in the Sierras. And that he had not violated them. And therefore, they made themselves readily available to him, seeing them, and that he had communicated with them.
So this is an actual police report full of Bigfoot, Bigfoot, Bigfoot. Skip's story changes, though. First, he says he dropped her back off at school. Then, okay, yes, he did leave her up there, but it's all her choice, man, because she ran away with the Bigfoot colony. Well, he saw one of the supernatural creatures, and it had taken the form of a blonde girl. They are paranormal and shapeshifters, after all. So Teresa and the girl were frolicking through the mountains, and he couldn't catch up with them, and he tried hard. But finally, he gave up and left.
He says, if you want to find Teresa, just go up there. So they do. With Skip's directions, they find the campsite, but they find evidence Teresa was there. They see some girls' clothing and a purse full of Polaroids. Some of them are of her, happy posing in the woods. But the forest guys that tagged along notice the backdrop in the photos are about 20 miles from where they are. This is a decoy campsite. Investigators eventually find the real Ghost Canyon site, but no sign of Teresa or Bigfoot.
The search ramps up over the next couple days. The Madera County Sheriff's Department gets involved, a mounted posse, tracking dogs, and an air search thanks to another agency's infrared-equipped helicopter. But they find no evidence of anything. No blood, no body, no crime. While they did get Skip on two crimes related to taking Teresa, a minor, out of school and also for unlawful concealment of a child, a judge formally charges him on June 16th, and he spends some time in jail, but detectives, of course, want more. They think he killed Teresa and they want to get him on murder. So much that prosecutors drop the other charges in case they find her body in the future or more evidence over concerns of double jeopardy.
Police never, though, sadly find her body and never bring more charges against Skip. But you could say he spent the rest of his life in a mental prison. His family members say he lived in his own personal hell, tormented by his thoughts, often soaking in the bath for hours at a time and scrubbing his skin raw with soap.
Yeah, lye soap. He died in 1998 of a heart attack about a decade after Teresa disappeared. Blind Johnny followed another decade later. And Teresa is still missing. The case still unsolved. There is one man who has spoken with all of the key players in this case and went to Ghost Canyon to investigate himself. Hear his hair-raising tale next.
You're listening to Crimecasters Network.
We are now joined by Jay O'Connell, who literally wrote the book about this crazy case. And I would say to you, Jay, like, what got you interested in this case? But I think everyone at home already knows everything.
Well, the hook that got me into this case, which ultimately I don't know if the case is so much about this, but it's the thing, the hook that attracted me was, I will confess, Bigfoot. And I got to Googling Bigfoot and my hometown area of Sequoia National Park and came across a story about an area called Shut Eye Peak in Sierra National Forest, just north of where I come from, up just east of Fresno. And it was a story about several disappearances in the same area, a couple hikers in the early 2000s, older gentlemen who both disappeared without a trace, a couple, 3 years apart. The son of a ranger way back in the 20s or 30s, and this young girl from Fresno named Teresa Beer. There was very little about Teresa's case, 16 years old, and she had disappeared.
And it really does tug at your heartstrings because you think about this little girl never really had a chance, right? And then after the police stopped looking, it was like, it kind of went away. And I know I mentioned to you that I would pitch this story and kind of get turned down a lot, but you decided to take the initiative and you were like, Teresa Beer, people need to hear her story. And you ended up writing a series of articles that ran in your local paper and then turned into more.
That was the whole sort of driving force, is to figure out Teresa and what was her story. Nobody had really told her story. What little that had existed just, we knew nothing about her. And so I started digging to her story and found out that she was a victim long before she ever went up to the mountains with Skip Welch.
So many people, when they hear this story, I know their initial reaction after getting all of these details are like, this really does, you're a Hollywood producer, this feels like a movie. We have Skip, we have the 16-year-old girl, we have Bigfoot, we have Blind Johnny.
Johnny, who's a character you couldn't make up.
When you took a deep dive into this case, you really had to take a deep dive into these characters also. And the person that I know a lot of people have questions about is Teresa's oldest sister, Yolanda, because she's really the only one who had a stable upbringing at all, living with great grandma. And I know that you expressed when speaking with her that she's really sad now, right? I think she harbors a lot of guilt about that time.
Yeah, she does. And I learned a lot about the Teresa's family through Yolanda. The one sort of overall theme I've always felt about this story is there was no advocate for Teresa when she was missing. And then when her story was kind of forgotten, we don't know what really happened, but we do know he took her into the mountains. Yolanda even expressed, you know, some guilt, some sadness that, you know, she said to me, she says, I wish, you know, maybe I had served that purpose of being the advocate for her and everything. But she was young. She had just had a baby and she was, you know, had a life that was, you know, difficult to some degree. But well, I think to this day, she regrets that.
I imagine that it's very difficult and she lives with that every day. But again, yeah. It's never too late to be an advocate. And I love that she spoke to you now. And, you know, hopefully together we can shed some light on Teresa and get people talking about this, because when they start talking about it, you really can't stop talking about it. I'm sure a lot of my family and friends are sick of hearing about Bigfoot and the Bigfoot case, but I know that you have gone up to the area that Skip called Ghost Canyon.
Just Ghost Canyon,
kind of describe Ghost Canyon, because even the name Ghost Canyon makes me think of a movie. This is like so surreal. What's it like?
For anybody that knows Sierra National Forest, it lies just to the south of Yosemite National Park, and it's just expansive. And the first time I went up there, I drove, and it was in May or June, certainly the summer season to some degree. And I drove for miles and miles and miles, never saw another car. And went up to where probably the beginnings of Ghost Canyon, and got out of the car and got on the trail with my little backpack and never saw another soul the entire hike. I hiked about 3 miles up in there. And it is very desolate.
Okay, desolate. And I imagine you would probably tell me if you had seen Bigfoot, but something strange did happen to you.
I am an avowed Bigfoot skeptic. I don't completely disbelieve it entirely, but I'm not a Bigfoot necessary believer. And as I'm walking out there having, you know, 2 or 3 hours on the trail, miles from my car, not another human being in sight, I remember thinking to myself, boy, if I believed in Bigfoot, this would be kind of scary. And I was on my way back to the car, still 2 or 3 miles away from trailhead easily. And if you know anything about Bigfoot, you know what the term knocking is. Bigfoot believers believe that somehow the Sasquatch community will communicate by knocking two large pieces of wood together. And I'm walking along and I heard, seemingly from very far away, very deep wooden sound, you know, I stopped and I went, didn't sound like a woodpecker. I grew up in the hills. I know what a woodpecker sounds like. I started to walk again and then,
wow.
At that point, this non-believer felt the hairs on the back of the neck start to kind of rise a little bit. I took a breath and I got over it and then continued to walk. And, you know, to this day, I don't know what that sound is.
Is it possible, Jay?
Yes. Yeah, no, again, those knocking sounds are supposedly the Bigfoots will warn you off of their territory. And that is a warning sound the Sasquatch will make to warn you off of their territory.
Did it work? Did you leave?
Well, I was leaving anyway. I had to go home.
Did you leave a little faster?
I did a little bit of a little
hop in your step.
A little hop in my step, yeah.
I tried to take Bigfoot out of the story, and you can't tell
you
it
can't.
Without it. So,
well, because it also somehow, if you just look at the fact, the story he told, why would he tell that story? Why would he not just say she ran away?
If he didn't believe what he told police, I always wondered why he would come up with something. It's almost so ridiculous that you would know you would get blamed if you said this, yet he said it anyway. So that leads me to believe he truly believes whatever happened in the mountains was something paranormal, or even if he did something himself, maybe he was possessed by what he believed to be Bigfoot or this Bigfoot society.
Yeah, I mean, there's that section in the police report I just kind of flipped to because I looked at it today, where Skip finally says, okay, I'm going to give you the truth bigger than life.
I would expect that Detective Stokes was like, all right, good. Finally, he's going to tell me what he did with this little girl. And then to hear Bigfoot kidnapped her, what was going through his head?
You have to imagine what was going through his head was that this guy's batshit crazy. You know what I mean?
Right.
In a way, though, that's not necessarily the central mystery of this story for me, as everyone's thinking the same thing right now. Did he kill her? And most people who are listening to this right now thinking, oh, yeah, he killed her. But to me, there's the mysteries are what happens with this case following that.
You know, the prosecutor being like, we're not, you know, we're going to drop it. And then how frustrated was he over the years knowing that his main suspect is just out there living life and Bigfoot chasing and maybe taking more girls to Ghost Canyon.
Another mystery is, what was Blind Johnny's part in all this? Even Detective Stokes told me, he said that they had kind of discussed the possibility that Blind Johnny kind of set this up to a degree, not that he asked Skip to go murder her, but make her disappear.
There are so many theories out there, Jay, and you've raised so many amazing questions. Again, your essays that turned into a book, Meth, Murder, and Bigfoot, it really blew me away. And I was so excited that you had done this work after I pitched the story so many times and they laughed at me. So I'm so happy and I can't wait to continue the investigation with you. I know we have a lot more work to do, but I'm and I know you are.
I would love to continue with you because I'm basically an amateur at this. I'm kind of like, I don't know if you've seen the Murders in the Building, the Marty Short and Steve Martin thing.
Hulu, yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of like those guys. First of all, I'm almost as old as they are, but I'm a total amateur. And for me doing this, it was kind of like being in my own podcast. And I look back at it, I listen to some of the recordings of my interviews and stuff, and I just keep kicking myself for not being a better interviewer.
Well, listen, I can teach you those things. If you can help me navigate through Ghost Canyon and possibly if I hear Bigfoot, you're in trouble because I'm going to run so fast the other way. But I will have a camera with me. So I really look forward to that. And I know that we'll be able to help each other. But until then, let's just hope someday we know exactly what happened to Teresa Beer. Thank you so much for being with me today, Jay. And I hope you'll just further this discussion with us online because I know people are going to have so many more.
Totally. In closing, I just want to say what one of my favorite fictional characters, his credo was Detective Harry Bosch always said, everybody counts or nobody counts. And that's always been my feeling with Teresa, is that that little girl counted. And for her to be ignored and that story to be ignored, it just adds injury to insult.
Continue the conversation with your hosts, Alicia and Ronnie, on any of your favorite social media platforms. Find us at Crimecasters, and let's talk true crime.
This is a part of the program where we go off script and talk about the things we would when we are investigating the case to each other. Ronnie, I've told you over the years, I tried to pitch this case in sweeps several times, and I always got, does anyone have anything that doesn't involve Bigfoot? And I always thought sweeps was a good place to do it. Explain how sweeps works.
I would say if you're going to do a story like this as a television reporter and just like a local market, this is the time that you would do it. So sweeps, for everyone out there, it's what we consider kind of our promotional periods, right? There are four or five particular times of the year that we're able to pitch these bigger stories that require more investigative skills and put them together and put in more time and more resources and add the graphics and the music. This, to me, would be a perfect sweep story because it's a talker. And, you know, sadly, at the end, we always have to remember there is a person involved here. And we never want to lose the focus of the person that has disappeared. But the more people talking about this case, maybe the more people will be talking about her case.
Right. And the saddest part is no one was looking for her outside of the police or the people assigned to this case. There wasn't like the family. I remember one time they interviewed Blind Johnny like 5 years later and they were like, are you still looking for her? He's like, oh, she's dead, man. Or she got sold into sex slavery. Like, literally, there was one article in the Fresno Bee, Pablo Lopez, the reporter, who is a great reporter, did the story on him and kind of followed up. And it's just like, nobody looked for her. Nobody cared. And that was the most difficult part. Now, there have been theories about this case outside of Bigfoot, outside of Skip. I know that Skip's daughter, Chandra, has been outspoken about the case. She gave a lot of incriminating interviews to police at the beginning about her father. I have a record of all of them. But she's kind of changed her story now to defend her father after he died. So to be fair, the Speed Freak killers, they were convicted of 4 murders, but police say they may have killed up to 72 people. And it was in the same area. Teresa's name was actually put on a list of possible victims of the Speed Freak killers. And that is what Chandra, Skip's daughter, always says. Yes, it was the Speed Freak killers, but police actually ruled her out completely. So it wasn't the Speed Freak killers. And if we're saying it wasn't Skip, who does that leave? A lot of people close to the investigation believe Blind Johnny may have been involved in some way, shape, or form.
We're talking about a very remote area. Any other disappearance of individuals or reports of disappearances of individuals in this area?
Oh, my goodness. Well, if you listen to kind of the outliers out there who talk about these things, they'll say that there have been hundreds of people who have just vanished in this area. And this area has been tied to some pretty crazy cases. There was a 14-year-old girl, Stacy Aris, who disappeared. She was with a group and she went off to take some pictures. Her father was actually on the trip and she literally vanished. They brought out search dogs and the whole thing and they never found any evidence of her. That was only less than 20 miles away from that site. And so, you know, and if you listen to the people who believe in Bigfoot and believe in paranormal activity in that area, they'll tell you that they have tons of evidence of other cases like that where people literally just vanish. I want to go back to the real evidence in the case, though, which is per the police report, when they went out to look for Teresa, you know, they'll go to the family and they'll ask for something to use for scent, to pick up the scent.
Right.
And usually right. The family will give a teddy bear or, you know, their favorite sweatshirt. Blind Johnny went and gave them a pair of white cotton panties with blood stained all over them. And the detectives were like, what the heck is this?
Right? I could just see their face, right?
Well, like, first they had heard this crazy story from Skip about Bigfoot. Now they go to see her guardian and he hands them bloody underwear. He said, well, she had just started her period for the first time, one day before she went missing. And these are her underwear. And it's like, I mean, just even that is so callous and it just seems so bizarre. And there was no like real caring or thought. Nobody went in and helped on the search. So, you know, just another evidence of how her life was living the way that she did. Skip did have one more clue. And I know all of this plays out like a movie, but that interaction between Skip and Detective Stokes that we read about in the police report, Skip went and gave Detective Stokes a rock, like much later than this happened. There are actually a few rocks, but one of them was larger. And he said, this is a clue. So basically, if you want to find Teresa, here's the evidence that will take you to her. And Detective Stokes, a couple years ago, said, I don't really know what happened to the rock. He said another detective was coming along and looking for clues in this case because every few years they do go through all of this again in the cold case department. And he took the rock, but the detective had actually just had it out front at his house for years. And so he just walked by and he would remember Teresa, but no word on what the rock did. If you come back to the Bigfoot thing, which you intrinsically cannot take away from this case, you cannot tell this story without Bigfoot. You'll remember Carrie Stainer, the serial killer, the Yosemite killer. He says he killed because of his multiple Bigfoot sightings in that same area. So, you know, I come back to this, Ronnie, and I know it sounds crazy, but I come back to all of the calls I made about this case, all of the people I've spoken with, all of the people Jay have spoken with have said They have seen strange things in this area, and I'm never going to not believe the Native American tribes that lived there long before we were here that saw something strange and felt something strange in this area. What is it? I have no idea. But could there be something? I don't know.
And with that, our resident true crime genius weighs in on this case, and we'll have our closing arguments next.
It's time to get schooled by the teen sensation of true crime.
Here's our resident boy genius with this week's sidebar.
Hi, my name is Ryan Custer. I'm an 18-year-old pre-law junior at the University of Texas at Dallas, and ever since I was 9 years old, I've been researching cases, attending trials, and poring over hundreds of thousands of pages of court documents, all in the name of true crime. On today's episode of Sidebar, we're going to be discussing something that is absolutely fascinating, which are unusual defenses to murder cases. A Bigfoot defense is not typically what one would see, even when we're picking apart the weirdest defenses to murder cases. What we typically see is some sort of element being kind of blown up as like the Twinkie defense. For example, a man in 1978 was convicted with diminished capacity for an assassination on the mayor of San Francisco after his defense presented the idea that he was an extreme depressant as a result of his excessive consumption of the Hostess snack cake Twinkies. So it became known pretty universally as the Twinkie defense and inspired California to change their laws. Another case that comes to mind would be the theory put forth by Michael Peterson's defense team after the trial that an owl had attacked and killed his wife and somehow miraculously made it look exactly how a murder would look. Or the sleepwalking murder defense, which we hear quite a bit about. In Arizona, that's been used unsuccessfully. It was used successfully by a man named Kenneth Parks in Canada back in the 70s. He was acquitted of the murder of his in-laws after he drove 20 minutes in a snowstorm and axed them to death. So unusual defenses are more justifications. It's very rare that you would see something so unusual like a fictional, mythical beast committed a crime that I'm accused of. So on that note, I have been super stressed from exams, so I'm going shopping, and I will see you guys on the next episode of Sidebar.
Time for closing arguments, and I'm going to start off with this. Is Bigfoot real? The folklore is alive, but in 2019, the FBI released a four-decade-old file on Bigfoot. Turns out, they actually started the file on Bigfoot in 1976. The findings of the file are on the internet, but basically it comes down to this. The FBI concluded hair submitted from Bigfoot was actually deer hair. So does Bigfoot exist? After all of this time with no conclusive evidence, I don't know, but I think it's been used as a decoy to attract innocent people like Teresa. With the terrain being so remote, to search is really so hard. So the best way to make sure we don't have more victims is to use Teresa's story to hopefully save the next person who may fall prey to the person who says they want to take them out to find Bigfoot.
You know, as reporters, we have to start with a fairly clean slate, toss out the paradigms in order to go where the facts lead us. If I would have said a few years ago that UFOs 100% exist and our government would show us evidence, you would have thought that was ridiculous. But it happened. Tens of thousands of people have shared their Bigfoot stories over the years, and I would never write off that many sources. And as Ronnie said, the FBI took it seriously enough to test out those hairs sent in by a known Bigfoot researcher. No doubt there are a lot of people who have mysteriously disappeared in the Yosemite area. Just check out the list of National Park cold cases. To be clear, do I believe Bigfoot kidnapped Teresa and introduced her to a paranormal society of women worshiping beings and that she is eternally frolicking through fields of spring flowers in the foothills? I want nothing more to be true, but of course not. But I will say that the idea of some supernatural force in Yosemite isn't so far-fetched. With the metaverse and artificial intelligence set to make a more active role in our lives and senators demanding more answers about confirmed UFOs, isn't anything possible? And of course.
So you believe in Bigfoot?
I'm not going to say no. I will not say no. Of course.
Right between the lines.
As you mentioned, we have to keep Teresa and Stacey Aris, of course, in our thoughts and prayers. And let's end by thinking about Teresa. May you someday get the justice you deserve.